Hello, Adelaide. How's everyone going? It's very hot. We've got a low energy crowd. Come on. Hello, Adelaide. Oh, yeah, there you are. This is wonderful. We are here today to celebrate the elemental power of storytelling. And so, as we share our stories here today, let us acknowledge the story of this place. We meet today on the lands of the Kaurna people, custodians of the waterways and lands of the Adelaide Plains, first peoples, first poets, first dreamers, first art makers. May we endeavour to cherish and protect their stories and the stories of all who have come before us. My name is BJ Silcox. I'm a writer, critic and chair of this year's Stella Prize. I'm also the artistic director of Canberra Writers Festival. But my guest today is Helen Elliott, a remarkable Australian book critic. When I started out as a critic, Helen was one of the only women I could see who had managed to build the kind of career I dreamed of building. She was a guiding light in the cultural murk, a firefly spark in the dark. I have admired her arts journalism for a long time, but now she has a memoir, and it is magnificent, a literary treasure box. Before we talk about that book, I want to ask you to join me in a dive into the well of memory. A little weird for a writer's festival, perhaps, but I want you to close your eyes and conjure your child self. The house you lived in, the clothes you wore, the questions you didn't know how to ask, the terrors you didn't know how to name, the bird song, the sunlight, the music on the radio, the food on your tongue. Can you imagine that child? Can you see them? Who were the people who shaped that child? The people you loved, the people who loved you. Not just your family, but that quiet network of teachers and neighbours and honorary aunts and uncles, the friendships, the mentors, the passing acquaintances. Helen Elliott's memoir, 11 Letters to You, celebrates these catalytic relationships. It is a love letter, an elegy, a time capsule, and a study in kinship, a sensory joy. But it is also a work of quiet and potent politics. It's a book that invites us to consider the monumental power of the ordinary, the prosaic. When we tell our stories and write our histories, we think of these as the background details, the flourishes, but they're not. This is where the living and dying happens, in classrooms and bedrooms and suburban streets and perfectly planted gardens. Attention, writes the mighty Simone Veil, is the rarest and purest form of generosity. Attention, taken to its highest degree, is the same thing as prayer. It presupposes faith and love. Absolutely unmixed attention is prayer. Helen Elliott knows how to pay attention. Please welcome her and join me in welcoming her.
Oh. Thank you. Thank you. That was wonderful, overwhelming.
Well, I love your book and it's very dear to me. And Helen and I had the chance to meet in person yesterday, and the first thing I told her was, after reading her book, the very first thing I did in my head was start to make my own list of people who I might write letters to. And I actually did. Instead of writing a memoir, because there's an incredible craft inside this, I actually wrote letters to people to tell them how much they'd meant to me, including connecting with a high school teacher and telling him that it was his fault that I turned out to be a literary critic. And he wrote me a report card back, which was very lovely. Helen, you have written before that the satisfaction of writing this book, of making it as good as I can, has been unlike anything I've ever known. A necessary joy, the deepest new, an entirely selfish pleasure, a small and ravishing bomb inside me. Can you talk about that sense of detonation?
Detonation. at the great age of, 75? I was detonated. I've had to work all my life. I've had to work for money. So you don't really have a lot of time to be as creative as you want to be. You need time to think, and you can't think if you're working out there for the dollar. So the pandemic was quite a boon to me. And I live in Mount Macedon in Victoria, on the side of a mountain with a beautiful garden, an acre of garden and a stream. And so for however long it was quite wonderful. I didn't have to be nice to my grandchildren, whom I love beyond belief. I could be as selfish as I liked. So I'd say at 75 I discovered how to be selfish, because also women my age were trained to be submissive and unselfish. So anything I did for myself, I think, all my life, I'd be thinking, oh gosh, you know, I shouldn't be doing this, I should be doing something else. So I just had this time to do what I wanted to do, and it set me thinking about... I sat down to write about these two women, old women. They were nurses at Gallipoli, called Viola and Elfrida, and it started there. I said their names, I could see them, I could feel them, I could hear them. They're in my DNA, these people, all of these people. It's also a love letter. It's a memoir. This is a memoir about me growing up. It goes from the 1940, I was born in 47. It takes me up to 69 when I finally got to university. And I had all sorts of jobs and things on the way. So it's just a very small slice of my life. But doing it, I did feel, oh, I've got something here that's quite remarkable. And I don't know whether it was a release of, okay, I can be as vain and as selfish, as egotistical, as I can just be totally myself in a way I've never been in my life. And it's taken a very long time to do that.
It is a book that's 65, 70 years in the making, and yet I think it would be inaccurate to say that this is a book about adult wisdom. If anything, it's a book about the incisiveness of children, the things we see and know that we don't have a language for yet, and that you gave your child self a language for what they saw. It's a book very much anchored in that childhood incisiveness.
Yes, I think I was a peculiar child. Boronia was about an hour. We didn't have a car, and an hour from Melbourne, so I don't know if many of you were growing up in the 1950s. It was a very dull time. Real life happened elsewhere. I thought, so real life for me happened in books, and it also happened in the neighbours, wonderful neighbours, because we used to go into one another's houses. Boronia, by the way, was an outer suburb. We had about half an acre, big gum trees, and we went there after the war and tried to... Everybody had this sense of peace and the idyllic, I think. They were recreating a new world. But it turned out to be quite a dull world for children, so I used to rush around to all these, mainly elderly women who lived nearby. I loved women, I loved old people. And that's pretty strange in a kid, I think. So.
You write, "I knew that children know things that adults think they couldn't know."
Oh, well, children are great eavesdroppers, aren't they? And they observe things. And my parents were not... They were just the most... They had great capacity to love. They were wonderful people. In fact, in writing this book, I wanted to... It's a love letter to my father, love letter to my mother, even though the 11 letters are to other people. I'm threaded through there. And my parents, too. And they're very deeply unhappy marriage. I think my father was... probably gay, been gay and married in the 1950s, 60s. You could still go to jail. It was terribly hard, I think, and that children know things. They see unhappiness, they see suffering, and they take it in. And I think it does inform your life. I'm with Proust. You know, you just need a childhood, you just need to be loved, you just need to be seen, and you'll be okay. You'll be okay.
It's, do we forget how astute and incisive children are? How do we manage to forget it? I think you have this incredible capacity to recreate that understanding, and yet we seem culturally to forget.
Yeah, we're trying to make them little adults now, aren't we? I don't know. I think I didn't know. I thought everyone was same as me. I think I've got synesthesia. I hear colours and see, you know, different, not full on synesthesia, but I've certainly got. So that makes my memory very unusual. Things are retained, and I see things in a different way. But I don't know about children nowadays whether they have time to. We didn't have a television until I was. Until 1961. And when we got a television, I decided I wouldn't go to school anymore. I'd stay home and watch. I know every movie made from 1930 till 48. And I thought 48 was, I don't want to watch it because it'll be too modern. I was in 61. And I fell in love with all those film stars. And I tried to emulate them the way my father, who was an orphan, he grew up trying to be Cary Grant. And you know the old joke, Cary Grant said, well, everybody wants to be Cary Grant these days, even I want to be Cary Grant. Mm-hmm. He was Archibald Leach, of course, born to a very poor family in London. But my father certainly turned himself into Cary Grant. And
you do have this remarkable, it is a remarkable mind, a remarkable memory, and I wondered how much of the sensory detail, because this book is so rich in sensory detail, the colours of plants, the taste of food, the sound and the place is so beautifully evoked. How much of that was inside your bowerbird brain and how much you had to go and then research to pull back? Was it waiting for you to just unlock it, or did you have to research it?
No, my brain, it's always there. I said to somebody the other day, my brain must have about 20 million post-it notes in it. And that's what it is. So I just have to, these days it's taking a bit longer to pull them out. But generally I can. My partner of 49 years hates me for it very deeply. We have to separate.
Because you remember the punchline to every argument? Or?
Well, no, I remember things and that he doesn't want me to remember probably.
What I love most about this book is it's actually deeply unsentimental.
I hate sentimentality and I hate nostalgia. This book isn't. Buy it if you're into nostalgia. I wasn't watching those films in the 30s and 40s as they do now for nostalgia. I don't know why I was watching really, How to Behave really, but there was a double, you know, we were in classes of 50, 60 in those days, so teachers didn't look at you. So you had your parents, but I don't know where we learned to behave from the cinema, I think. We learned manners, we learned artifice. We learned that there was a wider world than the Australian bush. And I think that stayed with me. I find Australia and Australian bush difficult now because I'm inculcated with something else, something very, very deep. But it's books in general, isn't it?
But you're trying to get at something. You're not longing for the past, you're not idolising the past.
No.
This is a book that's very much about a clear-eyed picture of the past, including its people. These letters are steeped in gratitude, but it's a clear-eyed sense of gratitude. You're not creating heroes. You're looking at people as they were, and if anything, some of it isn't particularly flattering, but it's beautiful because you're able to see what the person gave you in all their conflict, in all their nuance, in all their inner conflict. It's a grateful honesty, in a sense.
Well, I wanted to call it 11 Letters of Gratitude, but the publishers thought that was the word gratitude was a bit irky, I guess, and probably was. But I wanted to write it. I really wanted to resurrect these lives, these ordinary lives. My three epigrams at the beginning. One's George Eliot, and you probably know, you immensely literate crowd, George Eliot's in Middlemarch at the end, Dorothea, they talk about the world is made up of Dorotheas, but they lie in unvisited tombs. These great and wonderful people, and there are statues up to other people. I wanted to resurrect these ordinary, dearest, darling people in my life, give them back some. Some of them have very sad lives. My Auntie Frances, who, she lived in Port Melbourne. It was, my family were upper working class, lower middle class sometimes, I don't know. My father used to do the garden in a suit and tie, but that's Irish, isn't it? So I don't know. I think I just wanted to retrieve them and what they meant to me. And the only ability I have, apart from gardening, is for words and for remembering them. And so sometimes I'd be writing and truly tears would be dropping into the keyboard. So with the just remembering with the intensity and love, because they're all love letters. And they're all dead except for, there are two men and nine women. Two of the women are still alive. And one of the women who's 87, she now calls it our book. And she's given it to everybody she's ever met in her life. And she said, it's Lois, my friend. And she said, you've retrieved, made my life something. I mean, that's an extraordinary, I'm not, I don't want to sound immodest about it, but what a sort of cuts you off, that sort of ability to string a few words together and say, okay, when I walked into the Box Hill Library in 1965, there you were, the most beautiful girl I'd ever seen, and smoking, the most beautiful girl in the world was smoking, she looked like Audrey Hepburn, and of course, she loved being told that, now that she's no longer that girl. But here I am all these years later, able to resurrect her. Am I being clear? I'm probably not. I've got so many things happening in my head.
You're being beautifully clear, and you're giving such an affectionate, generous account of these people in this book, and I think it's all the more affectionate because you see them. You see your father in all his complexities and all the ways he was pulled in different directions.
Mm. And my father was the most charming man under the sun. I was in love with my father. And in fact, I think if you have lovely parents, you never get over them. You love your parents forever. And they are the most, the solid and most wonderful things in your life. If you're lucky enough, as I was. My father was, 36 when he had me? And I was just... I knew he loved me more than he loved himself. I think I make a list of the names he called me. Baba, Kushla, Foxy, list, endless names. Treasure, precious, darling. That's why I was told by an editor once, oh, you gush, stop gushing. I love gushing because when I love people, I want to gush over them and pat them. I'm a dog, really. I'm an affectionate dog. Woof, woof, woof. She's a dog person.
I am. We did joke that if we ran out of things to talk about, we could just talk about how much we love our dogs. That and Eleanor Ferranti, and we'd be here all day.
Yes, yes.
Let's do that little Eleanor Ferranti.
Eleanor Ferranti. Wow, Eleanor Ferranti. She gave me the language. She's... if you haven't read Eleanor Ferranti, you are... it's shocking, isn't
it? Let's do a vox poll. Who... A whoop if you've read Eleanor Ferranti.
There you go.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good.
Pretty good, wonderful stuff. And this Neapolitan writer, who is probably a woman called Anita Raya, everybody, nobody knows who she is. No publicity, nothing. And she sold more books than anybody in the history of the world, basically, because we know exactly why, because she's given women a language of emotion. I'm sorry, all you blokes out there, you're probably rolling your eyes and raising your eyebrows, but you're just going to have to bear it for a few minutes because she really... I remembered, I was talking to BJ yesterday and I said, I remember reading quite recently, rereading Far From the Madding Crowd, and Bathsheba says to, I think it's Boldrewood, he asked about her feelings. And she said, and this is written in 1874, and this is Thomas Hardy. She said, how can I... Oh, it's very difficult talking about my feelings. How can I explain them when I have to use a language written by men to explain their feelings? And I couldn't believe it when I saw that. And I think Thomas Hardy is superb. I've always loved his stuff and I've always loved his women. But Eleanor Ferranti talking about Lenu and Lila, two girls born in 1944, Naples 44. If you're a war aficionado, you'll know Naples 44 is an extremely, August 54, extraordinary time. They were born into ruin, poverty, and they were both brilliant. and they both just flew through the world. And Ferranti's given the history of these girls up until when did she stop? About
when they're in their 60s.
In their 60s, yeah.
And one of them disappears.
One of them disappears, but and Ferranti, aficionados all over the world say, okay, are you Lena or are you Leela? I'm Leela, by the way. Today I'm Leela.
What's wonderful about those books is it refracts a female friendship. Well, a female friendship refracts decades worth of politics through its emotional nuance and range. And people read them and say, oh, it's just a book about two female friends. And it's not. Mm. It's a book about everything. It's a book about politics. And your book is exactly that. It is love letters to neighbours in their gardens and to librarians and these kind of people. And yet all of life and politics is in here. And it's a particular kind of it's the politics of the everyday. It's the politics of living. And it's class. And that's what I really want us to talk about, is that this is one of the most astute books I've read in so long about Australian class and that gap that people don't understand, that clever children not from the upper middle classes have to traverse in order to participate in the intellectual and cultural life of this country. Can you talk about this as a book of class? Can you talk about this book as a book about class?
Oh, absolutely. I'm very interested in, I'm just reading Christos Tsokos' new book. Superb. He's always superb on class. He says things without embarrassment and he goes to an amazing length and places in a granular detail. I'm very interested in class. My father was theoretically he did say he was a socialist, but he loved the Queen. people are complex. But his politics were always of the left. I've been handing out how to vote Labour for all my life since I was my brother, Clive, and myself, we'd go to the polls and do it for Daddy. And my father would listen to politics on the radio, called then the wireless, every time it was on. And I used to think it was terribly boring. But he wasn't interested in himself. And I'm glad we talked about Simone Weil. My father was more interested in other people's being than his own well-being. You know, I've heard people say, I married into a family where they say, look after number one first and then you can look after the other. I was brought up exactly the opposite. Look after everybody else and you'll be okay in the looking after. I mean, my mother was a very devout Christian. I went to church, the Anglican church, and I just couldn't believe in God. Even though I believed in fairies, and I believe that typewriters had fairies in them until I was probably about 20, that's how all this magic happened. But the class thing was difficult for me because my father, we just didn't have money. You need money to make money, it's so true, and nobody wants to talk about money, but I talk about money forever, as Jane Austen does. Look at her letters. Every letter mentions money. Can I afford this dress? Can I afford these gloves? I have to trim my bonnet again. Mary, you know, and I came across somebody years ago, said her father had actually said to her, yes, marry for love, darling, but love where the money lies. And I was very perplexed about this. I married for good looks. And eventually I married him, but he was the best looking. He looked like Terence Stamp. And is there a woman here who wouldn't have married Terence Stamp? Mm-hmm. And he's still very good looking, and that's why we're together, I think, after 49 years. Believe me, it's as good a reason as any. Really is.
I showed Helen a photo of my husband and she approved. So
yes,
I feel like I've made a decent enough choice.
I did like the German Shepherd more though.
Oh no, that's my brother.
Oh yes, I know, but your brother's very good looking.
Yeah, I'll tell him to watch out.
Good looking men are quite unusual. You know. Well, you know, I always thought that. But what I was going to say about class, I should be stop being trivial. I had to leave school. I was very clever. And our classes were at my school, Boronia High School, no longer exists. And it didn't even have a matriculating form. So the kids were streamed, of course. You'll all know this. You were streamed into... If you were clever enough at year one or whatever it was, year eight, you'd go into professional. If you were a little less academic, you'd do commercial. And if you're an absolute dope, as we all... You're allowed to say this and think it these days, think it then, which we all know it's absolutely... It's shocking. It's shocking. You went into the, you know, doing sewing or woodwork or whatever, and your life was planned out. But I was clever... And I knew I was clever. I did nothing but read books. My brother was clever too, but we had to leave school. All I wanted to do was matriculate and go to university because I knew that my people were there. I knew that because I read books. And I wanted to go to Oxford University. And I did in the end. And I have to tell you, Boronia High School's now shut. I'm the only person in the history of Boronia High that had a scholarship to Oxford to do her doctorate. I didn't finish it because of... men again, good-looking men. Oh. What's a doctorate or a scholarship from Oxford when you can have a good-looking man? That was the idea of women. Women then. Thank God for feminism. Anyway, it's...
But this book does capture all of those decisions that you make about what is possible, what can be possible, what you can dream, what you can do, and that social language that you have to learn. I was talking to you yesterday. My parents were teachers in rural and remote Western Australia, and I got into university and turned up on the first day, and I think I was one of the only people from my school to go to university, and I was there at the law school freshman event talking to someone who seemed perfectly nice, and he asked me the very Perth question. I think you can all know, where did you go to school? And I told him, and he said, oh, I'm going to go find some minge worth talking to. Yeah, and that's still happening in 1990s Western Australia. The idea that we live in a classless society is this wonderful myth we like to perpetuate that makes us seem like we're egalitarian and fair. And yet, in every one of these letters, you capture obliquely a socio-cultural history of people eking out a living in market gardens, eking out a living in what they could afford to do. And I think rather than a didactic book that tells us what we should think of the time, you give us a sensory book.
I like, to glance, the glancing through. And I have to say it was Proust, reading Proust, who I tried to read. I'm sure everybody's had the same experience. You know, I first tried to read him when I was about 13 because I somehow or other knew that there was this person called Proust that I had to read. I tried again, you know, many times, maybe 10 times through my life, finally, really over the last 10 years. And reading Proust, because I found him so incredibly boring. I thought, why should I be interested in an old gay guy in France all those years ago? And then I read him and my God, it was like, really was a comet. And then I listened to the audible books, which are a lifesaver to literary people. Neville Jason is a fantastic Proustian, and that gave me the courage, and that somehow or other, that released, in fact, that bomb. Okay, Proust can be boring. I can be boring too. So, you know, if you read my book, you can be bored or you can skip on, and that's what it's about. Eleanor Ferrante's prepared to be boring too. You've got to stay with it. Writers don't realise... If you stay with it, if you stay with the boring parts, you'll end up with something uniquely you, I think. Perhaps it's about not choosing the details, but choosing the boring.
That's a fascinating piece of advice. Prepare to be bored.
Prepare to be bored, yes.
Because I've always, when I think about Proust, I think about the letters that the last remaining Mitford sisters wrote to each other. And one of them said, is it too late for Proust? I hope it's too late. And I've been of that school, but I'm a deep Ferrante lover, so maybe you've convinced me that I should I should retry.
No, you're too young. And those Mitford sisters were appalling people, really.
Well, yeah, they're absolutely appalling people.
I mean, really. they thought they were poor because they couldn't go to Paris and get their dresses done by, you know, Dior. Nancy whinges in letters all the time. Oh, I could only afford two Dior this year. Really?
Okay, yes, they are appalling. Sorry, I repent.
But they're amusing.
I repent.
They're amusing, yes, yes. I'm smacking you around. It's all right. I love your dogs.
A lot can be forgiven if you have very good-looking dogs too. I want to say that this is a deeply, beautifully crafted book. It is a book that is six decades in the making because the craft of this is extraordinary. And I just want to read a couple of the one-line characterizations that she has of people. His courtesies were a series of swift masterpieces.
That's my father.
Practicality was your lineage, a family of capable people susceptible to beauty. You will not find... So funny, so deeply funny, but these beautiful, crafted lines of the most, some of the most exquisite prose I've read in so long. How do you learn to be so bloody good?
Oh, I'm just natural. I was born like that.
Oh, okay.
Like Venus rising from the shell. There I was, you know.
You do have a pre-Raphaelite quality to you, so.
Oh, the flattery. I love flattery. I believe deeply in flattery. This is get you on in the world. As a girl from my back, you know, class background, I discovered that, oddly enough, and this is very odd, people believe everything you tell them. Even though it is completely, obviously untrue.
You got an example? What's the biggest lie you've ever told and gotten away with?
No, because I'd be sued. And I can't, yes, and I can't write another 11 letters because I'll also be sued because my editor said to me, I did an interview in the Radio National on Sunday, I think, and I said, as with Julian Morrow, and in it I didn't go out with boys because I was too busy reading, and you don't have time. My mother used to say, darling, I'm really worried about you. There's something wrong with you. You won't go out with people. And so I end up, to please her, go to a dance at the Vauxhall Town Hall. My bag would be stuffed with a book. So I'd sit in the lavatory at the Vauxhall Town Hall reading all night.
That's what I did at my school ball too.
I know. Well, we're terrible girls. Look where we've ended up, in 40-degree heat. But I probably lost the train of my thought.
You were going to get sued.
Oh, yes, I was a 22 at university. This is 1969 when I finally got there. I had to work 6 years, this is the class thing, to save up enough money to get there, to matriculate, save money, you know, do whatever I had to do to get there. So by that time, I hadn't gone out with boys, but everybody, the 87% of Monash University who came from private schools, I really had found my people. I loved all these people. They were very nice, and lots of good-looking boys, and girls too. And one particular girl who had been having sex, I think since she was 14, she said to me in shock, 22 and still a virgin? You must be the oldest virgin at the university. And my partner said, you can't write further because I talked about being derailed by men, by men's beauty, actually, not so much their...
Not their brains.
Not their... No, anyway, not their... I'm not... I think sex is overrated too. Martha Gellhorn really thought that. But she was with Hemingway, so you would, wouldn't you?
Quote of the festival.
But she said to me this morning, I had an email, and she said, okay, your next letters are going to be called Derailed by Men by the Virginal Nun. I think that's right. Anyway, something like that.
I think the oldest virgin at the university is an excellent time.
It's the oldest virgin, yeah, but so there are probably no virgins exist anymore in any... Do you think?
Well, my favourite statistic...
Your favourite virgin?
No, my favourite virgin. My favourite statistic 10 years ago was that there are more nuns over 90 than there were under 60. But apparently there has been a great nunnering. There's a nun glut because the world is chaotic and strange and young women are getting themselves to a nunnery. So maybe you started or you're a trend.
I am a trend, yes. I quite like the idea of an enclosed garden. I spend about 5 hours a day gardening, so I like the idea of a walled garden and digging away and just, with a few dogs and a few nuns.
Yeah.
That'd be nice.
And a very good-looking picture of Jesus.
Oh, does Jesus ever look good?
I don't know.
Beards, I don't like beards. No, can't do that.
Okay, a clean shaven.
Facial hair, a clean shaven.
Cary Grant instead.
Oh, Cary Grant. Yes.
So there's a terror of ageing, of death in these pages. The child you capture is beginning to realise very, viscerally how fleeting it all is, and that the people that you're most fascinated by are in a different time zone to you, you say. Now you're in that time zone. What do we get wrong?
Well, that's it for you. She says I'm old. All these people were younger than... A lot of these people were younger. I am. I'm terribly... I feel very old. I had about 2 hours sleep because my heart decided it wasn't going to be very proper last night. And I thought, oh, damnation. The one chance in my 77 years to speak at the Adelaide Festival, and I'm dying in a hotel. I didn't like the idea. I loved old people, and I think this is very unusual. Maybe this is how I knew I was clever. I don't know, but I remember being about six, and I can remember I remember what school I was in class, so I do remember very clearly. And I remember looking at old people, old ladies, old men with their wrinkled, saggy, draped skin and their sparse hair, their gnarled hands, and feeling their suffering and thinking acutely, they were once like me. They were a little girl or a little boy, and I'll be like them one day. Now, I think that's unusual, don't you, for a six-year-old? But I make up a lot of things. I like exaggeration, I like lies, I like embroidering. But this is actually a fact. So I think I loved old people and they loved me, because that's why all these stories were about a lot of old people who... this child is actually asking me questions. This child is interested in me. And they told me wonderful things. You know, these nurses... These nurses next door to me, two spinsters, Viola and Elfrida Stapley, were nurses, and they used to watch in Alexandria from the balcony of that hotel the Australians being brought in from Gallipoli. And they'd be anxious because they would often see their friends, their brothers, you know, lovers or whatever. They would have been, Miss Stapley's would have been about in their late 30s then. So they told me all these wonderful things. They told me about their horses, their dogs. They grew up in Orbos. Their father selected land. So I was close friends with these women who were born in the 1880s. And here I am in 2024. I think it's some sort of miracle, don't you? I'm a museum of these people, a walking museum. They're my flesh, blood, they're everything. They're in me. And I still love them.
I do think that deserves a round of applause. That's...
Oh, thank you.
And I think this is a deep hymn to that connectivity, that deep hymn to the idea that we hold those stories. But what do you know now as a woman in her 70s? What do we miss? What do we get wrong about age?
Everything really. Simone de Beauvoir. I want to actually write a book about aging. Simone de Beauvoir wrote a book, and it's called Aging. And she said, "There's this club. All our lives, we know there's this club. We're very aware of it. They're all around. People who belong to it are all around us. But we don't ever think we'll get there. And then suddenly, you find yourself in the club. And I don't mind being old, and I'm quite happy to die in the Intercontinental." I was worried about how they'd ship my body back.
And that's another great title, Happy to Die.
Happy to Die in the Intercontinental. It's got a syncopation.
It does. Oh, well, it could be a country music song.
Oh, wow. Well, I don't know. I don't believe in wisdom. I think I heard somebody say the other day about, you know, life is really a play, a Shakespearean play. There are the first two acts and you have no idea what's going on. And it's mess because life has no narrative. Life is just a complete mess, chaos. And which is why, by the way, I think you might as well... No, I won't say that. That's really indiscreet. My favourite quote, by the way, is Christine Keeler, who said indiscretion. Discretion is just another word for hypocrisy. So I'm being terribly hypocritical. But I've forgotten again what we were talking about. You'll have to catch me up.
This is wonderful.
No, I'm just...
You riffing. Don't believe in wisdom.
I don't believe in wisdom. The third act actually enables you to reflect back and say, that was why I did that. You know, and I can look at my still beautiful partner of 49 years and say, that was why we've endured 49 years.
So it's not wisdom so much as hard-earned hindsight.
Hard-earned hindsight. That's very unromantic, isn't it?
It is.
But who believes in wisdom, really? And your wisdom's in you can't get it, all these silly books on, you know, endless stuff. Oh, I've turned 50 and I know this, I know that. I'm about to turn 77 and basically I understand nothing except that actually to go back to be neat about it, that my parents' big thing was don't tell lies, be kind to everybody, and you are not important. Everybody else is important. And you're not number one, you know. Look after everybody else. And I think this is true. Kindness is all. The good. Go back to your Christian, those wonderful parables, you know, the Good Samaritan and the prodigal son. That's how I'd like to live my life. And, see people through kindness and love, as my parents saw me through kindness and love. Doesn't mean I haven't been a frightful... Oh, there is a chapter in there when I did something terrible and I thought I'd be guillotined for it. Really guillotined, because I was only 7 and I thought, oh, my God, if they find out what I've told a lie and someone will come and guillotine me.
So it's not wisdom, it's the kernel of what's been there all along.
What's been there, yes, it stays, I do think, your childhood. Of course you develop and of course you learn to contain yourself and develop and, you know, improve yourself, I hope. My life's been a process of class climbing and self-improvement. Oh, well, the class, I wanted power. Class is about power, you know. I think I grew up saying I'd done this instead of I did this. And I had to go for this job at the Box Hill Library and I desperately wanted this job. And somewhere at the back of my... I was 17 and I realised on the train, I was a 17-year-old virgin, I might as well have been 7. I was so innocent and so ignorant. And I thought, I need this job desperately, desperately, desperately. And the way they'll employ me is if I speak in a different way. And because I'm a good mimic. And I had been watching an actress called Kay Kendall. And some of you very old might know Kay Kendall. She's very beautiful and she speaks. She's got this delicious accent. And she does say things like, oh, you are delicious, darling. And her consonants are crisp and wonderful. So I thought, oh, I'm going to be Kay Kendall. So I went into this. I went into this interview for a job. And 17 and said, and they said to me, oh, they're enchanted. There were 8 men around the table. And so I trip in, being Kay Kendall, and pipe smoking, the Shire secretary and the librarian, all men employing this darling little girl, really, and who was pretending to be someone else. And they said at the end, oh, you've got the job, of course. And I was exhilarated. And at the end, they walked me to the door and, you know, the librarian put his arm around my 18-inch waist or whatever it was at the time and said, and which part of London do you come from, dear? And a geographical moron, I hadn't been anywhere. I'd only been into Melbourne on the train and back to Boronia. And I said, I think he said, which part of England? And then the only place I knew was London. And he said, which part of London? And I nearly fell down the steps. For some reason I thought I heard of St. Martin in the Fields. I gaily said to him, it's St. Martin in the Fields, being Kay Kendall. And then as I got to the station, so exhilarated, I had this job. This is all true, by the way. And I had this job. And I thought, I didn't swear then. I didn't actually hear the word shit until I was 18. But if I had, I would have said, fuck me. For the rest of my life, I'm going to have to be Kay Kendall. For this job that I thought I'd have forever. So there you go. It's that's what imagination can do. That's not in the book, by the way. That's just especially for you and Adelaide.
I hope
I look like Kay Kendall because I loved her clothes. And we were talking about dresses later. And the only reason I work these days is so I can buy frightfully expensive dresses and look like Kay Kendall.
Anyway. But there's class in your body. You didn't know what you were doing, but you were doing something, and it was about
bridging
that cultural gap.
But I wanted the power that people, that I just didn't have. This is what nobody understands. You can hear me becoming very emotional about it, which is wonderful. Actually, you should be. We should all be emotional about class and what it does and how oppressive it is and how it stops people. And the fact that that tradie who comes in and you whinge about paying him, you know, $110 for a quarter of an hour, he works damned hard for it. And you, you know, with your Melbourne grammar sailing through, I had a boyfriend, my first boyfriend is a Melbourne grammar. By the way, his mother wouldn't let me come into the home because she said, oh, she went to Burnie High. She really didn't. This is 1960, 1970. And they are told at Melbourne grammar, well, you are the power brokers of the world. The tradies are not told this, but they would, they'd be quite happy to work, do their work for, you know, 115. That'd be too low, in fact, wouldn't it?
My husband's private school friends used to call me his bit of country rough.
Bit of country rough, yes, you are. I can see that.
So rough.
Yeah. Oh, dear.
Yep.
Well, I'll lend you one of my Kay Kendall dresses, and I'll give you elocution lessons.
And I can teach you how to shoot a pistol, and we'll be...
I know. She shoots. Can you believe this?
Yeah.
Rootin', shootin', tootin', whatever. Gal from Albany.
Yeah.
This is going to be your memory.
Albany, love.
Oh, yes, but don't forget I'm Kay Kendall. I'd say Albany.
Yeah, you do. You do.
That's it. You got to get
it. We are going to take questions from this fabulous human in just a minute. I have one selfish question to ask you before we do. You are an astonishing literary critic. What makes a good critic?
Lying? I don't know. I have no idea. Just like, I mean, people like us, we do nothing. We're books. I said to you yesterday, we're not human beings, we're books. Because she mentioned Willa Cather as my Antonia, and then she reached across and gave me a great big kiss on the lips, and she said, you're the only person in the world who's ever read my Antonia.
No, it was Death Comes to the Artist.
Oh, it was Death. See? Oh, well, sorry, Death Comes. No, you said everyone knows my Antonia, yes. There you go. Look, I'm showing my age. Put that post-it note in the wrong box. But no, I don't know what, seriously, don't what, I think criticism, a lot of stuff is all about self. I think the way you can, you can't actually rely on literary critics on the whole these days because it's such a business, book selling. And if you follow a critic, you can catch, you can pick up the nuances of what they say and you think, oh, I generally like what she says. But, you know, you probably know more about it than me because you're younger and you've thought about it more. I just fell into it because I like being a smart aleck.
Well, pretty much the same story. Just
smart aleck.
Just a different time zone.
That's true.
Do we have any questions for Helen? I have plenty if we don't. Okay, Helen. If you were going to write a literary version of this memoir, other than letters clearly to Proust and Eleanor Ferranti, who else would you write letters to?
Oh, Annie Ernaux.
Annie Ernaux, yep.
Dickens. Trollope. I've been reading Trollope. You all must rush out and buy Trollope. Trollope's wonderful. He doesn't go into deep psychological things, but he tells it as it is. If you haven't, Trollope's never dull. He's superb, and he makes you realise that the Victorians had an extremely vivid sex life.
Oh, yes.
Yes, well, I don't think anybody has a sex life, but I think it's, you know, Trollope actually does. It's amazing.
By Racy Trollope.
Trollope. And in fact, I saw something about Byron. I thought I'd read more Byron. I don't know who else. Edna O'Brien is wonderful too. But would I like to read her again? I don't like reading people. I was not the same person I was, you know, all of you. You don't want to read what you liked at 20. You, half the people were reading, what was it, The Art of Motorcycle Maintenance and thinking it was an act book of genius? Not me, by the way, not me ever. But my partner was, and I thought I might leave him then, even though he was phenomenally good looking, because he liked that book. I think you can judge people by what they read, by the way.
No, a friend of mine went home with someone she thought was very good looking and then bailed on the whole thing and she said, too many Dan Browns, too many Dan
Browns. Oh, no.
Yep.
Well, my other friend who's had a lot of sex said she never sleeps with good-looking men because they've never had to try. I don't know. This is your sex therapy session for the festival. You can come to us afterwards. We have a lot of...
Well, yeah, we're incredibly qualified.
Yes.
My name is BJ. How has writing this... How has writing this book changed your relationship with yourself? With that child self and with yourself now? How has getting this down changed it? Has it?
Yes, it has, because I think all my life I've wanted to write and, you know, wanted to explain this book. I have to say I don't like memoir on a whole. I think it's... Honestly, you would know too, you'd be reading these memoirs and everybody wants to write it because everybody's life is valuable, but not everybody has the skill to write it. That's the other thing. I think I've found a form. A lot of people, it's a new form I've invented. I didn't mean to invent it, it just happened like that. And it's. I think I've wanted to write about my experience to say, look, this was me then. And every day I miss my mother and father still. I miss my, you know, wasn't my brother glorious? Weren't these people next door glorious? Wasn't that man that I was in love with when I was 16 and working in the Postmaster's General office and not having a clue what I was doing, and they basically fired me. They sent me upstairs where the idiots were. And I was absolutely... I actually asked my father, oh, when this man's around, I can't stand up, Dad. And I lose my voice. And he was really embarrassed. Of course, it was lust. I had no idea. But he, because this man was my boss and he was 45. Now, he's a 45-year-old man called Mr. Cohen working at the PMG, public servant. Now, why, you know, I closed the chapter on him talking, you know, this man explained to me what honour was, what decency was, and also desire. So...
And it's a beautiful relationship like because it is so rooted in decency. We have actual questions for
a question.
You. Fantastic. Step to the mic.
Hello. I really enjoyed your stories. The very first one, though, which you've mentioned quite a lot today, I felt really upset when you went off to school and you forgot all about them. And they die without knowing how significant they've been to you. So I wondered how you wrestled with that regret.
Well, in fact, that's why I wrote... They were the first people I wrote about. Of course, you know, we do. We never say to people who love us, who are kind to us, who do things for us, and young idiots that we are... But we are forgivable. We just rush off into the world. Actually, I didn't really. I would always call in when I could. But I did when I got to, you know, difficult times in my life, I forgot them. And it was very hard. I felt guilty all my life. So this book is reparation and for that. But that's a wonderfully insightful question. You obviously feel the same way. Yes, everybody does, I think.
If there's anything to take from this book, it's that. Not to go away and write your own memoir, but potentially to do that, but to find the people in your life who shaped you in ways like this that are so quiet and so potent and tell them while you still can that they meant something to you. And then if you can't tell them to remember in this active, beautiful, sensory way. We have another question. We have time probably for one more question.
I just wanted to ask you about your lovely description of going for the job interview. How long were you able to keep up the pretense before you got found out?
I didn't hear the question. So
how long were you Kate Kendall? How long did you manage to keep up the pretense of that job?
Darling, forever. It's been my job for the last 60 years to be Kate Kendall. Okay?
I think that's probably the perfect place to leave this. Please join me in thanking the fabulous Helen Elliott. Oh.
Thank you.
How nice.
Oh, you're a lovely audience. Thank you.